So here we are in week three. Now, it turns out I may have to make yet one more adjustment to my schedule, but I'll let you know more about that either in the orientation for next week or next week. But we will definitely go ahead and have our meeting next week, so no immediate changes. Let me say what I started to say before I turned on the recording, which is I appreciate that we've been doing this for a long time. I guess 72 sessions. When we finish, it will have been 72 sessions in all. That's a lot. So I appreciate everybody staying with it. You know, there's a couple of things to say about that, it seems to me. One is that as we go through this material, as we go through the TSK books and through the structure that the that Wen Rains lays out, I think it's really pretty remarkable how much knowledge there is, how much there is to learn wherever we turn. Every time we start a new topic or a new session or a new reading, there's just so much going on. There's so much to happen. So David makes a comment saying he really appreciates the course, and I've heard that from other people, and I appreciate it too for exactly the same reason, or the reason I just started to say, which is there's just so much to learn and investigate. So that's the one side of it. Now the other side of it that I find, and I imagine other people find also, is that it's challenging in the sense that, you know, nobody can hold all of this in mind. I think, you know, let's imagine we did all of this in terms of a lengthy retreat. Let's imagine a 3-month retreat, just to pick a number. I could imagine working our way through this material, but even then it would be difficult. No, that would be 3 months would be enough to spend one day on each session, you know, with a little left over. That's not really enough either. So, and even then, we, you know, from week to week, one topic would kind of slip out of view and another one would arise. And actually, you know, I think that's just fine. It would be wonderful to think, you know, I'm going to become a master of the time-space knowledge vision. And maybe that's a good goal to have, but I don't think that means that you know, that you can be working in all these different domains at the same time. I just don't think that's the way it works. Not for me. You know, you take up one topic, and it's immensely interesting, and you can see how you could work in that mode, with that particular set of concerns or those focuses for inquiry, and then you move on to another, and you have to let the first one go. You know, you can't do it all at once, and I think that's fine. And of course, it ties in with the one of the themes that we're looking at this week, and certainly have looked at many times, which is that, you know, you can find, let's talk about great time and space and knowledge for a moment. They're available within ordinary appearance. You know, it's not as though you have to constantly be reminding yourself or kind of holding on to something and say, oh, this is what TSK is. No, it's you rediscover the vision in each moment. In another context, Rinpoche has used the image of a child holding on to a balloon with a string. You know, he says you get this insight, you get this understanding, and you have to hold on to it tightly like a child holding on to the balloon because you're afraid otherwise it will fall away. And that's not right. What's right, what's more accurate, is that, I don't know if I need to use that image, but you'd say the whole the whole world is full of balloons. You don't need to hold on to any particular balloon. It's a very bright and alive world, and very light also, which I guess the image of balloons suggests. Well, okay, that's just my general reflection. And with that in mind, Klaus says, puts this nicely, I think. He says, the body of knowledge manifests in all details, still staying the whole. Yeah, we've said this again and again, but you don't need to go somewhere else. You don't need to have some special experience. We're talking about a vision. And in one sense things stay the same, in another sense, because the vision is different, everything is different. So with that in mind, I wanted to do a very quick review. It's absolutely hopeless this week to have a sense that we're going to really talk about all the things that at least I've singled out as valuable. I won't even try. We'll actually spend quite a bit of our time today, I think, doing an exercise and discussing it. But nonetheless, I want to start off just by reviewing where we are in this session or what we've done, because I think it's helpful. You can start fresh in every moment, but it's also sometimes helpful to be able to keep in mind how things fit together from at least from one week to the next, let's say. And especially this week, I suppose, because we're rereading something that we read just a couple of weeks ago, the section from TSK, which we're going to start with today. So just a very quick review. In the first week of the session, we were talking about the importance of intimacy and appreciation. The truth of the self, the reality of the self, and of course it's not reality in the sense that it's the whole thing, but the truth of the self, or I didn't say that very well, it's not like saying this is what the self really is, but this is what the self proclaims. The truth of the self is that it's separate. In the reading, for the first week, it said that the self is an object timed out by time. And in that sense, it's like everything else. The self appears as part of, through the dynamic of what appears, the dynamic of appearing. But the self has this remarkable quality. There's this thing we can do by virtue of being conscious. And in particular, the special way, it seems, that human beings are conscious as compared to, say, frogs. The self makes itself a subject. It's not just an object that's timed out by time. It takes on this special role of being the one who knows. And then, of course, in doing that, it makes all these things to be known. So we get this mind and thing structure, which we talked about in the first week. And the idea here is that through intimacy with what appears, we can penetrate that or move through it. And when we do, we arrive at the level of clarity. And we'll be talking about clarity again this week because the theme for this week really is the light of knowledge. So light and clarity clearly go together. So that's where we stand, in a sense, after the first week. Now, there was a comment here from Ken. Let's see. So slips out of view. I think one thing slips out of view and another arises. Worth considering. Does a view slip out of view, too? It sure seems so in conventional terms. What about in other terms? Well, I'm not going to pursue that too far, but you're making a very important point, which is any way we choose to characterize this. And when I say, one aspect of the vision slips out of view, well, that in itself is a view. That, when I say that's what happens, and it's worth questioning, or it just naturally presents itself to be questioned, if that's where we choose to take our inquiry. And that's one approach. Okay, so week one, intimacy and appreciation. Last week we talked about the body of knowledge. And I thought it was really helpful to go into that, in part because people are always complaining. People who try to get into the TSK vision and find that they can't really, they say, well, it's too abstract, it's not embodied. And people really want to go into the embodiment aspect. And often, because a lot of people who come to TSK do so through engaging Rinpoche's other writings, often they'll say, kumye, couldn't we do some kumye in TSK? And when people present TSK in classes or workshops, they often want to do some kumye. And the sense is relaxing our commitment to the way things are, loosening up, being ready to consider other possibilities. And that seems just fine. So here, last week, we looked at what I would say is a deeper level of how you would approach embodiment from a TSK perspective. So you would start with our embodiment. Here we are in our world. That's where we have to stand or start from, and that's where intimacy and appreciation come in. We're our intimacy with the world is an embodied intimacy, right? And there's a lot of interest these days in consciousness studies and what they call embodied cognition. We know things by interacting with them in an embodied way. So that's where we start, and that's where we work with, or the sense of intimacy comes from. And so that then becomes natural to say, well, we're going to leave conceptual knowledge behind. And that's kind of the intuition behind wanting to take an embodied approach to TSK. Concepts are not going to do it. We need to engage at a deeper level, where intimacy is natural. At the same time, though, and this is what we looked at last week, you certainly can't stop with the usual sense of having a body, being embodied. And that's, Rinpoche makes that clear in the Kumye books too, the embodiment that we're talking about is an embodiment of the whole. And so partly that means embodying our sense of being embodied in the physical world that we inhabit with no separation. That's one aspect of it. The other aspect is that really everything that shows up is a part of the body of knowledge. So when we start talking about the body of knowledge, we move beyond maybe the our usual sense of embodiment, which has to do with, belly and throat and feet and all those good things. But the body of knowledge is everything that appears in an embodied sense. So the walkabout exercise, which I wrote up in the transition, points toward that. We work with the senses. We also work with the mind, which is a part of the body of knowledge. And ultimately, the body of knowledge involves the whole of everything that appears, physical space and linear time, but also our concerns, our thoughts, our wishes and fears, and so on. Whatever appears is given by knowledge in the reading. This week, I think it's the reading from Dynamics. Rinpoche writes, "Knowledge gives permission," and the giving permission is a kind of how can we say that? That's a part of the body of knowledge. That's really all I'm going to say. Now, this week we go back to the idea of clarity. We're going to focus on that a lot, and I haven't really said much about how clarity relates to the body of knowledge, and I won't, because we have to start moving into the new material. But clarity, of course, is a term that has to do with light, and here we're talking, this week, we're talking about the light of knowledge. That's the theme for the week. So luminosity and light and how that relates to the body of knowledge. So maybe that helps give us a little background for what we're going to do. So let's do it. See how far we can get. As I said, I want to set up a practice, and then that'll probably be most of what we do. So we're reading this section from TSK, which we read before, we start off by getting clear about the idea that the world as we ordinarily understand it is a kind of subject and object world, or a world of mind on the one hand and things that the mind is aware of. So there's a knower, this is a different way of saying it, a knower and the field of knowables, the field of what's available to be known. So the problem is, there's many problems, and we could come at them in many different ways, but the problem, part of what's talked about here in these first few pages from TSK, is that the knowing is not attributable to a knower, and there is not exactly a field of knowables. You know, as soon as we talk about knowables, we're talking about this thing and that thing and the next thing, all these different things that the knower can know. And that's our ordinary vision of reality. That's exactly the vision that we're replacing. Maybe replacing isn't quite the right word. But we are looking to activate, that's the verb we've been using, we're looking to activate a new vision. And that vision is not going to talk about knowers and knowables. So you could talk about the field itself. So there's a field of knowables. I read something just recently that made actually quite a nice point. And that was talking about the different senses. And now each sense has its field, and in fact that's language that we use. So if you see a car going by and at the same time hear the car going by, in one way, the seeing of the car has more to do with seeing the person on the sidewalk than the hearing of the car, because there's the field of seeing and all the things that are in the field of seeing together. That's one set of knowables. And then there's the field of hearing. So even though we relate the seeing to the car and the hearing to the car, that's more the mind connecting things up together. Just on the level of the field of the senses, all the seeables are one kind of knowables, there's one field of knowables, and all the hearables are a different kind of knowable. But in any case, in either case, we have the field of knowables or the many different fields of knowables. So, talking about all the things that kind of get collected together in the field, is the kind of standard way, you might say, we would think about that. But we're actually looking at a different aspect of the field, which is the possibility of clarity that is in the field. The field has a fundamental clarity to it, and that's where we would like to go. Now, of course, when we talk about a field, that's a little misleading because there isn't, you know, a thing called the field. But talking about the field is a way of putting aside or rethinking the emphasis on the things that show up in the field. So when I was reading about this, I started thinking about quantum fields, because I've always been kind of interested in this. You know, fields are, I find this a particularly interesting way, talking about fields, a particularly fruitful way, I should say, into the vision, and that's something I want to be working with more in the future. But that means that I've been interested in this idea of fields, and so it's always been a little bit difficult. Anything having to do with quantum theory, quantum physics, is, I find, challenging. But I found a very nice, very simple discussion. It was a report, just like a two-page article, reporting on a talk given by a physicist who was talking about quantum fields. And the physicist is Sean Carroll, and I'll try to remember to put in the orientation a link to this little article, because it's quite useful, I thought. I found it very clarifying to use that word. Anyway, what he says about fields is that fields are fundamental. You know, there's particles. We're used to thinking in terms of particles. I mean, physicists, or at least people who have kind of a basic knowledge of physics, think about particles. You know, atoms and molecules, or subatomic particles at a deeper level. And the point that Sean Carroll's making in this talk, which the article is about, is that fields are more fundamental than particles. A particle is just a kind of excitation in the field. And he ties that together in a very nice way with trying to make sense out of all the excitement about the Higgs boson a couple of years ago. As he said, you know, people were terribly excited about it, but nobody really understood it. He said it's not that hard to understand if you think in terms of fields, and so you can look at the article to understand why he would say that. Now, the thing about quantum field theory is that it is it's only confined to the physical realm, and the fields that we're talking about are, of course, not confined to the physical realm. So, one way of thinking about this is that the field of our experience, and it can be a shifting field or there can be multiple fields. You know that Rinpoche talks about multiple dimensionality at various points, including in our reading here. You could think of that in terms of multiple fields interacting with each other. And actually, the Sean Carroll article makes that point that different fields, there are different fields and they interact with each other, and that actually is why the Higgs boson, he says it works, but I'm trying to stay away from talking about that. It's really only, you know, it's helpful, but it's not the same as what we're talking about when we talk about fields. But because there are these different multiple interacting fields of knowledge, we can say that the quality of clarity is what unites them. So that even if in a particular field or in a particular mode of appearing, let's say, what shows up is not knowing and confusion, and Rinpoche talks about this very specifically here, even if what shows up is not knowing and confusion, that doesn't mean that the fundamental clarity isn't there. It's just that that's the particular manifestation in that field, right? So let's take a quick look at page 283. He says, he's talking about there's the darkness of not knowing, of confusion and not knowing. And he says, on one level, you can reverse that. But at a deeper level, it's really even not necessary to do that, because if you're in touch with the clarity that is available in any particular field, you can discover, he says at the bottom of the first full paragraph on 283, eventually we can discover that there never was any darkness or not knowingness. It's only because the self insists on knowing in a particular way that we get confusion and not knowing. So in that particular field, that's what's going on. And you could tie that back into the discussion of bodies of knowledge at the beginning of... where was it? In Dynamics last time? Last week's reading, anyway. There are particular bodies of knowledge, and you could say each body of knowledge has its field, right? But the body of knowledge, with the big body of knowledge, that's where the clarity is, and that is available within any field. So that's a very fundamental approach. So the question I want to turn to now, and this will lead to the practice, is that's a kind of a theoretical presentation. I probably shouldn't use the word theoretical, because, TSK is never just operating on the level of theory. But I am using it because we may react. We say, okay, we think that through, and it makes sense to us. So now I have a kind of theoretical or conceptual understanding of why you would say that even within confusion and not knowing, clarity is available, let's say. So, okay, I get that, I can take hold of it conceptually. But how can we do it? How can we work with that? Well, there's a clue which we will use when we do the practice. At the top of page 282, it's a description of how clarity works. So let's look at that whole paragraph, actually. He says, there is no longer a looker. So that means in this vision, let's say, in the TSK vision, there is no longer a looker, someone who looks, but instead only a knowingness which can see more broadly from all sides and points of view at once. So that's what we're going to come back to in a moment, the possibility of seeing from all sides and points of view at once, because that's a very specific instruction. How would you go about doing that? And if you do that, or if you experiment, if you make that a kind of inquiry, what does it mean to look from all sides and points of view at once? What is that like experientially? Then new possibilities open up. So we'll look at that. And he goes on, he describes it a little further, he makes the distinction. He says, more precisely, the knowing clarity, that's what we're talking about, does not radiate from a center. In other words, there is no knower. Right? And in that sense, by the way, the idea of seeing from all sides and points of view at once, it potentially misleading, because when we think about seeing, we always think about there's a particular point of view from which you see. And the suggestion of seeing from all points of view is still, it seems like talking about the field of all the different knowables. There's a field of all the different seeings. But that's not exactly right. That may be how it starts. But there is a seeing, and as he says here, the knowing clarity does not radiate from a center, but is rather in everything. And everything is in it. And again, when we say it's in everything, it's very tempting to immediately identify all the things that knowing is in, kind of like in subject-object reversal. And again, that's transitional, because it's not the case that there are things that in which knowingness resides. So that's why it's important to look at the second part when he says it's in everything and everything is in it. I think that's, we'd like to move into that relationship where the knowingness is available at a deeper level than all the things that have gotten identified. It's this fundamental clarity, right? And he says there's neither an outside nor an inside, in the ordinary sense, but rather a pervasive and intimate in or within as an open-ended knowingness. So it's when we're in touch with that that the possibility that it begins to make sense, you could say, that confusion and not knowing are can still be examples or can still be infused, let's say, with knowingness. It's because the clarity is deeper than any particular field or field manifestation. So the next paragraph here is what I would like to do as an experiment. As an experiment, but I actually meant to say as an exercise. So this paragraph is presented as an exercise. I mean, it's very specific. It says, here's what we can do. To attain this knowingness, here's what we do. It says, to attain this knowingness, we can begin with objects and experiences, using them to work back to the knowingness and clarity which they bear. Okay. So that's the basic exercise that we want to look at. But you know, when you start to think of it really as an exercise, and you know, we've often taken statements in the books and say, well, this is really an exercise. It's not presented as a formal exercise, but it really is a way of investigating. It's a kind of an inquiry, and that's what we're doing here. And when we do that, we have to look. We have to be pretty precise. So he says we can work with objects and we can work with experiences. So those are two separate things, I think, for our purposes. We can start first with objects and then work with experiences. And what we want to do, so let's just focus on objects right now. Okay? We're going to look at objects, and typically this is going to be a seeing kind of exercise. There are objects out there over against us, you know, standing opposite us. That's the object. So we can start with the object, and we can use it to work back to the knowingness and clarity that the object bears. So within the object, as we said, even if that's a little bit limited, but within the object, there is this quality of knowingness and clarity. So how do we get to that? Well, that's what we looked at in the previous paragraph. At least this is one approach. It's certainly not the only approach. But the presentation, the suggestion is that we look from all sides and points of view at once. That's the basic practice. So we want to work, we take an object, we want to work back to the knowingness and clarity which it bears, and we arrive at that clarity by looking from all sides and points of view at once. So, what does that mean, to look from all sides and points of view at once? Well, you might start this. We're going to do this exercise now for just a couple of minutes because this is just the first part of the exercise. And, you know, we'll see. Maybe we won't get too far in just a couple of minutes, but maybe something interesting will show up. So, looking from all sides and points of view at once, one way to do that, and probably a good place is to start, is just at the physical level. So, if I look at a lamp in front of me, for instance, I always have a particular perspective on that lamp. Only one aspect of the lamp is showing up, but I know, in a very real kind of lived sense, I know that there's a back to the lamp and sides to the lamp, and actually there's the base of the lamp, and, you know, the part that rests on the table, and there's the very top. So there's all these different aspects of the lamp, and we can't see them all at once. We can only see from one particular perspective. But we could try seeing. We could imagine, this is just an imagination, right? We could imagine that we see from all sides and points of view at once. So that would be the physical way of doing it. So my suggestion is that you start with that. In fact, let's start with that for just a minute. Pick out an object and try, you know, imagine that you can see it from all sides and points of view at once. We'll do that for a minute, and then we'll move on to the other aspects or the other phases of this exercise. So pick out an object. Go ahead. Okay, so we're going to move through this exercise pretty quickly. You're welcome, of course, to go back to it on your own. Notice that what's being suggested is not that you first look at the object as you see it in front of you, and then imagine seeing it from behind, and then imagine seeing it from above, and so on. You do that all at once. You see if you can have all those different perspectives at once. All sides and all points of view. Okay, so that's the first step. Now the second step, we're still going to focus on a physical object. You can use the same one if you like, or try a different one. But let's interpret the term point of view more broadly. Because any object that we encounter not only has its physical appearance, but it shows up for us in a particular way. It has a particular meaning or significance. And that has to do partly with its history, right? So whatever object we see, it may be one we never encounter. We have some, a little bit of static, but it's gone away now. Okay.
That sound is coming from Klaus's.
Oh, thank you, well, Klaus. Maybe you can mute yourself. Thanks for keeping track. So in other words, the object has a history, most likely a history for us. We could imagine the kind of general history. If you're looking at a man-made object, for instance, how did it get constructed, or whatever the object, how did it get to be in this particular place? But then there's the history of how you began to interact with it, and the history of your past interactions, and there are various cause and effect relationships. How does that object relate to the objects around it? And then there's the distance between you and the object. There's so many different aspects. So I guess it's more natural to use the word aspect than point of view here, but it's really the same thing as far as I can see. So that's the second phase, is to look at the object in this broader sense, all the different aspects of the object, which relate not only to its physical presence, but its significance and its history, and the relationships it enters into with other objects and with you. So let's try that for a minute. Okay? Pick an object. Go ahead. Okay. So let me again comment on that a little bit. Again, it's you know, the suggestion is to do all of these different points of view at once, to bring them all together. And that raises a broader question, which is, you know, what are we trying to do here? One way to do this would be to say there's there's this aspect, I see it from this perspective and that perspective, and then I remember when I bought it, or something like that, you know, many different aspects. And it would be possible, in effect, to take the original object and split it up into a whole bunch of different objects, you know, the object that I'm seeing from this side and the object from that side, and the object that has a history of my purchasing it and that has a future that I'm imagining because maybe I want to replace it or whatever it is. If we just create all those little versions of the object, that's not going to get us outside the field of knowables. We're still going to be stuck in the knowables. So what we're really trying to do is move past that into this underlying clarity. So in a sense, we're kind of overwhelming the object. Or we're overwhelming our experience by just bringing in more and more and more and more until we're seeing from everywhere, and that everywhere has inherent in it this underlying clarity. Now, I've seen a couple of comments here in the chat box, but I'm not going to address those because I want, not right yet now, I will. Let's move through to the next part of the practice. So we've been focusing on objects, now we want to focus on experiences. Right? And we'll just take a minute here and you know, there's so much just in this one exercise, it's kind of almost frustrating. But we'll just take a minute. The basic idea here is that we want to take not the object, but our experience. Now, it might be the experience of the object, and that's fine. So you see the lamp, and you're focusing not so much on the lamp, but you're focusing on the experience. You're trying to look at all the different aspects of your experiencing of the experience. That's one possibility. And the second possibility is the same, except that your experiences might be not visual or not out in the physical world, but it might be the experience of feeling hungry, which is still kind of in the physical world, or the experience of feeling restless or excited, something like that. All those different kinds of inner experiences. And again, we'd like to be able to see those from all aspects at once, to see, to have the view from everywhere, is how I think about this sometimes. So, same practice, but now with the experience side. So, if for instance, if I remember something, I remember somebody, let's say, it's the experience of remembering that I'm looking at. Okay? So, let's try to work with that for a minute or two. Okay, so once again, we'll move on. I can only laugh because there's a lot to explore here. Doing this, you might begin to see how confusion, to take that example, could itself be an expression of this underlying or pervasive knowingness. That's what we're really interested in, is the pervasive knowingness, right? So there's a confusion experience. And if we look at it from all sides, if we investigate it, if we let it be there, there's a knowingness in the confusion, right? That's kind of where we're going. Okay, we'll do one more time and then we'll open it up and I'll start to look at the comments that people have made. The remaining aspect in this paragraph is we work back to the knowingness and clarity which the experiences and objects bear, right? And then we can see, this is what he says, when we arrive at that clarity, when we have a sense of that clarity, we can see all experiences as being preserved, it's kind of a funny word, but he's using it in a very specific way, as being preserved in a common ground. So there's nothing separating one experience from another. Our experience of last year and our experience of today both have the same clarity within them. And that shows that they're fundamentally linked. So the whole realm of experience is linked. That's what clarity gives us, right? He says the previous is not previous, the distant is not distant. And of course, the previous is previous on the level of content. Something happened last year, not now. That's what shows up. But at the level of clarity, all experiences share. They're all linked in the same way. So let's see if we can do that. We'll take a minute or two to do that, and then that'll be the end of the exercise for today. So moving to the underlying clarity and then letting that clarity be available as experiences arise, linking all experiences. All experiences share in that clarity. You could also say all experiences have a kind of intimacy, or all experiences share in the body of knowledge. But here we're talking about clarity. Okay, let's do that for a minute or two. Okay, we will stop there. And by stop, I mean we'll now start taking a look at some of the things people were looking at and exploring. There are already several posts. Let me say one thing before we start, and that is that the when you open up to all experiences, there's a flow of experiences, you know, this and this and this and this and this and this, and that's the way the mind tends to operate. And as with so many exercises in TSK, you can then kind of drop down, if you want to put it that way, and look at that aspect of the experience. That is, the experience of experiences following one another in a kind of a rapid movement, that is also an experience. And that's a part, you could say, of the view from everywhere, looking from all directions at once. Okay, so I just wanted to add that. And let's see what what people have been saying. We're running late, I'm sorry. We won't go past the hour. Okay. David wrote quite after the first part of the exercise, photograph of a loved one. The image is posed from years ago. I consider the living person then and now, what she was doing then and what she might be doing now, her feelings then and possibly now. A multiple dimensional feel for her presents itself. I consider my feelings for the photo, that's of course very different, my feelings for her. I imagine her feelings when she gave me the photo. A myriad of memories are recalled, a constellation of feelings and thoughts are building. Okay, well, that's a very nice description. You kind of moved on past the first exercise there to look at, you know, all of the different dimensions of meaningfulness. And let me just cheat and take advantage of that word meaningfulness to say that the reading we did from Dynamics, which we won't have a chance to talk about in the phone call, starts off with meaningfulness. But really, and that seems like it's very different from clarity, but it's actually the same thing if you look at it, or at least it's a different take, it's another aspect, you could say, of clarity, is that there has to be, before there can be meaning, there has to be the possibility of things being meaningful, of meaningfulness. So, I just thought I'd take advantage and use that. So, David, I think that's a very nice description. Ken said, does this more comprehensive knowingness, what we're looking at here, involve a quality of appreciation? I don't know. Doing the practice, the object, the butter dish, presented in a weightier, dimensionalized sense, it seems as if it became more itself. That's very interesting. Maybe the gravity of it, the weight of it, that's what you're saying, really. Second take, the object extended out into linear time, a multiplicity of linear time. It was giving relationally. Okay, so this is, again, these are really nice examples of the possibility of sort of experiencing an object or an experience in many dimensions at once. We want to keep in mind that the reason for doing this here is to let us kind of drop down into this more fundamental experience, to work back, as the text says, is to the knowingness and clarity which the objects bear and the experiences bear. So by seeing all these different possibilities, that's kind of a path that can lead us into that underlying knowing. So you say giving relationally. I think there's a lot to explore there, but I won't try to do it right here. Oh, you said it was given. Sorry. You correct yourself. It was given relationally. Well, in relation to you, in relation to its different manifestations in time, those are possibilities. There are many other possibilities. Michael says, allowing clarity to become central, seems to reverse the usual dynamic of active and passive. The self thinks it has to be active, proactive, but when it is following old paths, it is in a sense passively following the familiar. Yeah, it's a very interesting point. To allow ourselves to let experience express a global clarity, which the self tends to think is being passive, seems to require an active willingness to take a fresh look. So that those are really good thoughts. We don't have time to really say much about them. But I will say that it's worth thinking about that in terms of something I pointed to right at the beginning of the phone call, where TSK says, his TSK book says, the self is an object timed out by time. So in a sense, the self is passive. It thinks of itself as taking over, taking control, being the knower, the experiencer. But when it's busy being a self, it's in a sense very passive, and that's what you're pointing to here, Michael. I think it's a great theme to investigate. David says, within the building constellation of thoughts, I'm aware of the memories of past and thoughts of now. I'm aware of both past and present thinking and how they are here now in this present space. That's very much related to what we looked at, the previous is not previous, right? The distant is not distant. Everything's here and now in this present space. The constellation seems more open viewed in this light. Okay. And Ken comes back with a comment, and this will be our final comment. Third take, confusion is an aspect of the field. The welter of experience arises sort of as ghostly presences. So ghostly, that would be very interesting to explore. Ghostly in the sense of less real. That's how we tend to think of ghosts, I suppose. But maybe not. Maybe that's not what's going on. Okay, the welter of experience arises sort of as ghostly presences. Do insubstantial arisings, ghosts, bear clarity? Is clarity realized through emotional undertones and overtones? And the ghostly transactional states begin to live. Okay. So you're actually relating the ghostliness back to confusion. That's very interesting. Again, worth exploring. So one of the nice things about this course has been... of course, Ken and many of you have been studying TSK for years and years and years, as long as me in some cases. Still, in the course, I feel that perhaps we've created a field, let's say, not to get too cute, but perhaps we've created a field in which people can really express some very interesting possibilities and thoughts, and I only regret that we can't explore them in more detail. So we'll stop there for this week in the transition and orientation. I will say at least a little something about the reading that we didn't get to at all, but I thought it was important to work with this, the exercise that's implicit in this paragraph. And that will really, I think, be the walkabout for this week also, because that's available to work with at any moment. Okay, we'll see how that goes. Okay, thank you very much, everybody. We'll be back next week.